Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is the first special episode from the International Process Symposium Conference that we attended in June 2017 on the beautiful Greek island of Kos. So there are two of these specials. In this first one, me and Ella sit down with Professors Trish Ray of University of Alberta in Canada and Tamar Zilber of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem to talk about institutional theory, what it is, how it relates to process studies and organization studies in general. Really enjoyed talking to Trish and Tamar, both of whom are incredible scholars and wonderful human beings. Trish Ray is a professor of strategic management and organization at the Alberta School of Business, and she is one of the most prominent scholars of institutional theory. She studies things like organizational and institutional change, organizational learning, professions and professional work, and identity and role identity, some of which we talk about during this conversation. Tamar is a professor at the Jerusalem School of Business Administration. She is trained in social psychology, anthropology, and qualitative methodologies, and a little bit like myself, is building on these to develop a sound and thorough theoretical understanding of institutional work. So in this episode, we sit down with the both of them to talk about institutional theory, and it's a really interesting discussion, particularly if you're new or perhaps have been absent from the debates around institutional theory for a while. This should be a good refresher and also a decent introduction to what institutional theory is. Please enjoy our conversation with Trish Ray and Tamar Zilber from the wonderful island of Kos and the International Process Symposium.
Welcome to the podcast, and we're extremely happy to have you here. We're in the wonderful International Process Symposium here in Greece, which is a fantastic location for a conference. And the things we're talking about here is actually really fascinating. So the theme of the conference has to do with institutions and the process view of institutions. I'm not an institutions scholar. I've personally never been even particularly enthused by the idea of institutions. But being here, it's very interesting. I've learned so much about the different perspectives, the different views, and just the attitudes that people take. Granted, some of it may have been a bit facelifted to reflect institutions, it's fascinating. But you are actually in this boat. I'm very curious what you think of your experience thus far. We're in day one today. No, day two.
Day three, if you're taking into account the pre-conference.
Right. So I clearly need a better reference to time. what do you think thus far with regards to this way of looking at institutions? Because I think process view is relatively a new phenomenon in this field.
And maybe even for an outsider, what is a traditional view of institutions and how does this view fit in with that?
Well, first, this is a lovely place to be.
So wonderful.
Lovely place to be to think about really anything, but a great conference and some mix of young, energetic new scholars with some more experienced, energetic scholars, and lots of interest in thinking about the overlap, I guess, of process approaches and institutions, which is exactly what we hoped would happen here. I think that the really exciting things that happen probably come through the exchange of ideas that are inside a session. And we had some great sessions today where people come with their papers and talk, and others then partly agree and partly think there's new things needed to be added. So that's kind of like my introductory ideas, and I think Tamar can add some more meat.
My understanding of institutional theory is really that it is about process originally, because what we're talking about is the process of institutionalization, how structures and practices and way of thinking become taken for granted, and people just, their thinking and their acting and feelings, everything is really within this framework of the institution. So, for example, the institution, there's no sense to this conference like people came from all around the world to this island to just meet and talk. It doesn't make any sense if we didn't have the institution of higher education and science to give it any meaning. And so now we are all within this institution and we all take it for granted. And that's why we're making the effort to come and to speak and to talk. This is the idea of institutional theory. So originally it's all about the process of how things become institutionalized. But I think what the process perspective has to offer to institutional theory is that institutional theory is really a macro level theory, which means that the kind of classic studies where historical, going over a long period of time and looking at this process. But because it was through a long period of time and from the macro level, we don't really know the details, everyday details of this process. And what process models can help us do is really dive into the process and zoom in into the processes. So it's a good fit because institutional theory is about process, but on a different level. And now we can start playing with it.
That's so interesting. I never knew that about institutional theory, which probably highlights my ignorance of the subject, but that it's about process and not this almost stable-ish kind of an entity that has been conceptualized in this way.
By the end, once something is institutionalized, then it is stable.
Right.
And it's very, because it's taken for granted, so you don't think about it and you don't criticize it. But it's really about the process. How is that happen? And also how institutions are de-institutionalized. So what happens when, like, think about the family. The family used to be a very strong institution, right? Everyone thought that they have to get married. And then once you are married, you stay with your spouse and you take care of the kids and everything. And by now, this institution is really has gone through a process of de-institutionalization. And so many people don't get married, or they are married and then they're easily separating and getting divorced and stuff like that. So institutions can become institutionalized and then they can become deinstitutionalized. So it's all about process, I think. Right?
Yeah. And in the middle, there's also process of, so institutions are built up over time and then somehow they remain in place. So they do become taken for granted, and taken for granted is an important word in institutional theory, because when institutions are in place, we don't need to think about it. And in a sense, that's how we know that something is institutionalized, is that we no longer talk about it. And there have been some nice studies that show you how, as you're trying to build up an institution, there's a lot of language about justifying the reason for the things, the new things. But as that becomes more accepted and taken for granted, nobody talks about it anymore. So yes, there's the process on both sides. You're talking about the building up and the dismantling sometimes of institutions. And then adding to that, in the middle, even though we are taking institutions for granted, there's a lot of forces at play that maintain that. So it's a perpetuating, there's some perpetuating, I'll go back to forces in play that mean we can then have this resilience, incredible resilience of many institutions that persist for a very lengthy period of time.
Could you give an example of one that perhaps our listeners would be affected by an institution but may not even be aware of it, or it may just be taken for granted? The family is perhaps one that has changed over time but is still prominent.
Our last session, we were just talking about a study where they're looking at judges and judges in the UK system, and really relating that to the institution of law and justice. Depends, you can have some different names that you might call it. But, and we were, as we were talking, and I was saying, well, the institution of justice or law is incredibly important to society, and we take it for granted because we assume that if something goes wrong, as an individual, you have a way to go and complain and have a judge. Eventually, you've got to work your way through the system, but there will be a judge who will listen to you and listen to the other side and use a variety of tools that are established within the law, more than tools, structure, meaning. I could go on. There's a lot of different things that would be used in a predictable way, in order to come to a decision that then everyone will accept. So when you think about that, that's actually quite amazing that it exists and that it functions and that it serves to maintain societal order because people have a way to have their grievances resolved. Now, resolved may not mean you like the answer, but at least you've had your issue dealt with. So that's one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a pretty resilient one, yeah. Too.
Well, I think what your example really shows very nicely is that we create the institutions, and once they are created and established, we forget that we created them, and we treat them as if they were objective. And this is really what allows us as society to keep them going. Otherwise, we would start fighting on everything. But institutions really are part of they are the order that allows us all to keep on going. So we have this marvelous, for us, very interesting trait that we created them, but then somehow we feel that they are objective and they're just out there and that they're real. They're not, no, they're social constructions. So it's they have an amazing force. And so it's very interesting to study them.
Well, I guess the reality of social construction is a question to be discussed, especially that, what do we mean by real? Is it that we can't go and touch an institution, or is it because the consequences may be very real? As you pointed out, Trish, that the legal system is an institution, the outcome of which not everyone might enjoy, but it certainly has very visceral, very physical consequences, regardless of whether an individual even necessarily wanted to participate in that institution or not. It's sort of non-optional almost.
Yeah, I would say we all participate in it, whether we actually go to court or not.
Yeah.
Because we collectively support that.
Even if the judge decides something that you don't like, you don't usually say, we need to get rid of the entire legal system, and if the system is not good, and we should devise a new system. What you can say that this judge is a jerk, or I don't agree, or maybe I didn't put my case good enough, right?
Or my lawyer wasn't good.
Yeah, right. So you don't really question the institution itself. That's the thing. You may question how people reacted and what they did, yeah. But you don't question the institution. If we start questioning the institution, then we are starting to dismantle it.
Even though it's a social construct, it has very coercive effects.
Right, it's a very real consequence.
Which is crazy. You think about that. It's something we agreed upon, and then you can't just go and say, no, I don't want to play anymore.
Exactly.
And take you back in. And then you mentioned the perpetuation of institutions, so that they are a process, right, as they're being set up. And then as we begin to perpetuate them with unreflectively, then that sort of solidifies it, I suppose. But doesn't that sort of imply that the real meat of the matter is very much at the level of enactment? So as individuals go around performing institutions, isn't that then where the institutions are? Where is the kind of the larger overstructure in this situation? Because speaking of what's real or what isn't the performance of particular actions the only thing that could be really referred to as that which exists? And what's then the rest of the baggage?
Well, you know, this is a very, very serious philosophical question, and also it's an ongoing debate within institutional theory. So where are the institutions, right? That's the question. Trish just said it in the previous session, you can't touch them, you can't smell them, you can't see them, and still they are so powerful. So institutions are somewhere on the societal level. So there are really these meaning systems and ways of thinking about thing, and you can't really touch them or see them, but they are reflected in practice, in actions that people actually do. So we can only infer to them. Right now, of course, institutions are, this is a concept. There are no institutions in the world, but it's a very interesting and productive way to look about the world, to look at the world through this prism and think about the institutions that really govern what we are doing. So even maintenance, what you call perpetuating, we call it maintenance, institutional maintenance. So usually there's this question whether you need to be aware of your efforts to maintain an institution, or just by, you know, whenever I go to the ladies' restroom instead of to the gentleman's restroom, I maintain the gender institution within our society. And I don't think about it. I just go there, right? But by doing that, I really maintain the division between men and women and the assumptions that they need to have different restrooms. So it's in the action, very mundane daily actions that really create and then maintain institutions.
Mm-hmm. So just to add to that, if you're talking about the gender institution potentially breaking down, then you go to a Scandinavian country where perhaps they no longer have a different a toilet or restroom for men versus women. And then you may be faced with a quandary when you get there, which is
what should I do?
Really, you lose your bearings because the institution that you took for granted doesn't exist in another context. And that actually can then start to lead to questioning of your old space and the institution that is existing in a certain form in a new space. And then perhaps, you know, if the world all visits Scandinavia,
they could
you know, go home and question whether things are the way they should be. And so I think it is this questioning that's an early sign, perhaps, of whether institutions will decay or not. And sometimes we talk about them decaying.
Right. Also, I think it makes it clearer, this example that institutions are bounded in place and time, mm-hmm. historical time. So it's not, they're not universal. They're really part of culture, right? So some institutions, like the market, may be by now universal, but most of the institutions that really are created within a specific culture, and then they may travel to another culture. We call that translation, where they're really moving from one space to another, and they may change across history. So when you study institutions, you really need to be sensitive to space, time, process.
Yeah.
And what's the political dimension of this? Can people dismantle institutions, mm-hmm. or do they need to be left to decay? Can I enact some sort of agency against this institution and have some impact on it, or am I just shouting at clouds if I try?
I think we should be consistent with our metaphors. You'd be shouting at the restroom door.
Well, so there's an area of institutional research that's called institutional work right now. And the idea of it is that we call them actors. They could be individual people. More likely they're at a group level, at least, if not bigger, can take actions that are, and in the definition, purposive, but purposeful actions to try to change an institution, for example. Maybe there's three: create a new institution, to maintain one, to actually thoughtfully try to maintain an institution, or to deconstruct or dismantle an institution. So in that kind of literature and research, there is a sense that you could try to purposefully tackle one and say you don't like this institution and you try to take actions that would help it to decay earlier than it might otherwise. But I don't think we would ever put all of institutional theory into that category. I mean, I think that it's an important piece of institutional theory that there is an unthinking acceptance and perpetuation of most, if not many, most, I don't know, institutions are really taken for granted. And I come back to that word because I think it's an important part of institutional theory. But Tamar should add more about institutional work,
right?
Because she's done a lot more with it than I have.
So it's a question of balance within the theory, whether we emphasize how strong institutions are and how they impact actors. On the other hand, how much, whether actors really can impact institutions. And it's debatable within the theory. This morning, we had a beautiful presentation by Francesca Poletta, who's a sociologist from UC Irvine, and she studies social movements. So social movements are the kind of actor who purposefully trying to change reality, right? The social order. So she gave this example of course, all these equal rights movements, organizations, groups, they do try. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes less so, to change institutions, to change our conceptions of hierarchy within the social order. So in that sense, you know, I would like to be optimistic that actors can change institutions. Interesting question for us is how come actors become even aware of the institution so they can start working on it? And there are some very interesting ideas there. Usually it has to be some actor that is somehow out of the order in order to be able to reflect on it and then act on it. So for example, when you move to another country and you see that things are going differently there, and then you go back to your country, then you have the resources that enable you to start reflecting on the institution and do something. So there are very interesting studies trying to identify who would be the actor that would be able to do that, whether they need to be central to the network so they have enough resources to do that. Maybe they have to be peripheral to the network so they can... they have the interest to do it. So there are all kind of interesting questions come to mind when you start thinking about who can do that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Then we basically study and we focus on these individuals or groups of individuals who may be able to do that or not.
Right, right. So yeah. What we usually do is we'll see something that already is going on in the world, like a group that actually does something, and then we will start studying them and we will ask... and we start, you know, go back in history to see how did it start, who started it, how did they come up with the idea, what do they do, how do you do that, how do you start? It's very hard. We call it the paradox of embedded agency. If you are part of the institution, how can you come up with any ideas to dismantle it? I mean, it's really paradoxical. So this is the stream of institutional work, trying to figure out all these questions.
Mm-hmm. But then are we talking about dismantling, removing, or changing institutions as a form of, if not progress, then at least some kind of change? Because if it's a taken for granted behavior almost and set of ideas and values, do we just take it apart and replace it with something else? That seems a bit too structuralist. Or do we impact certain assumptions of it so it morphs into something else? And then there's a question that, you know, institutions, they're not singularly located.
Right.
It's a mesh, isn't it? And then they support...
it's a constellation.
Yes.
It's Jewish called. Yeah, constellation of logics. So you have different institutions, different ideas, and they're always integrated.
Yeah. I think that some of what you're asking is what people are trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's... when you think about process, the question of how is integral. And it's the how that I think... we are more recently getting better answers to how do they do it. Not just do they do it, because we can see that something has changed, but it's the kind of detailed, reflexive, researchers are often quite embedded in the context in order to get a good understanding of how things have happened over time, how actors did manage to think about something differently, even though they were embedded in the context. It's actually quite a fascinating thing to try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I do quite a bit of my work in the healthcare area. And healthcare is this wonderful area to study because it's so highly institutionalized. And we have many taken for granted ideas about the healthcare system. Within it, there's a real sense of hierarchy, that physicians are the most knowledgeable in all senses, that they should be controlling all the other activities within the area. And yet some of that is being challenged. And so I've done some work with nurse practitioners who are trying to study how they make a place for themselves in an area that it had been completely taken for granted that the only person who could give you the right kind of service was a physician. So they had to go through a number of steps in order to get themselves accepted, and we called it legitimized, right? So legitimizing is another important piece of institutional theory. Things have to be legitimate in order to fit into that taken-for-granted world. There's another way that I haven't been studying, but other people are, and I think it needs a lot more study, which is the impact on the institution of healthcare, which is coming from patient or people knowing a lot more than they ever used to know, and the internet and all kinds of sources that are pretty good. And instead of being the least knowledgeable person in the system, people, because they aren't always patients, I like to call them people, can actually think and that they can make some decisions. And that challenges the institution of healthcare. So who knows what will happen over time, but, you know, studying those kinds of challenges or disruptions is a fascinating thing that we can learn how it happens.
Healthcare is so interesting. And then we've got other dynamics going on where change is pulling from different directions. And
Absolutely.
You've got a kind of core ideal of what it means to be a nurse, for example,
mm-hmm.
that then is being destabilized by lots of different parties. For example, I was doing research on remote workers, and one group that I interviewed were nurses who worked from home, answering phone calls from the public
mm-hmm.
to offer basic advice about mm-hmm. what to do next. And one of the things that they said to me was that they felt they lacked legitimacy as nurses. They had all worked in hospitals and had their training and were keeping up with their certifications, but they felt they were not accepted as nurses because they weren't working in a hospital. They didn't have the same institutional framework. So on the one hand, mm-hmm. there's a new way of being a nurse being mm-hmm. Experimented with and enacted, but they feel far from the core. How do institutional theorists deal with these challenges to the mainstream, to the core? Is that a source of innovation and change that should be celebrated, or is it seen as a threat? What are some of the dynamics that...
Well, everything always depends on your point of view, right? And so from the institution of healthcare, the fact that there can be nurses on the phone giving advice to people was a huge challenge to the order. And in fact, physicians felt very threatened by that potential. And it's not that long ago that this really came into be. So, so is it starting to change the institution, perhaps? And does it also have consequences for the people who may not feel as connected to the system, may not feel that their roles are like they used to be or like others? Absolutely. And then that kind of, and I'm maybe they are disrupted by what's going on, and they are also a disruptor mm-hmm. to the institution. So all of that, we get to watch and see how that plays out.
This brings me to another point, interesting point about institutional theory. So you can either study a process of institutionalization or the institutionalization that are already done, and then you can know the outcome, and you can go back in history and see how it goes. But it's also very interesting to follow an ongoing process, and then you realize also that people act, but they don't always know where it will, what the consequences will be, and there are unintended consequences. And so we have these two different approaches within institutional theory, and many of the questions that you have to ask are actually empirical questions that need to be answered mm-hmm. in specific cases. So
kind of separating where process ends and institution settles in, it's more of an empirical matter. Because what you said, that if we're studying institutions as they're unfolding or growing, at which point do we know that we're studying institutions and not just some random offshoot outlier process?
It's a very good question. We don't always know. We can have some pointers. For example, some areas are more institutionalized than others. For example, in institutional theory, we have this concept of the field, which is a supra-organizational level of analysis, where you have all the actors that take part in this conversation that constitute the field. And then if you study the field, then at least you know that you are within an institutional arena.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you start your study and you think you are going to study institution, and then you get to this conference and you present and people ask you, is this really an institutional story? So God knows, right? So we don't always know. Especially if you study an ongoing process.
Well, also we're talking a lot about individuals and sort of groups of individuals. But what about organizations? Can we study institutions by studying organizations as entities or concepts? So instead of going and looking at what one or two people do or a group of people does, is there a space within these frameworks to go and look at, because organizations matter. Even though they don't exist just as institutions, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They have a place and right. and they have consequences. Can we study institutions through or by studying organizations?
Of course. No argument from us there. and completely, yes, organizations matter a great deal. I think within the concept of the field, organizations are part of the field. And so you might think of, it kind of depends on what you're studying, but there's going to be either sets of organizations or individual organizations that are key actors within a field. And so that's one way in which you might try to understand. It's the relationship between, if you've got levels of analysis, between the organization and the field would be a pretty common way of trying to understand institutional issues, institutional events, all kinds of things about institutions. I think then collectively, well, what, you know, there's so many things are organizations.
That's true.
Yeah. So when you think about studying the professions, which I do sometimes, then there'll be a professional association, which is an organization. And it has the characteristics of an organization and can take action and do things. So organizations definitely matter, and lots of people study them. And it's not like we can say they all act in one way.
Yeah.
So it's another space where a tremendous amount of research takes place. There's a big new handbook coming out, second version, called The Handbook of Organizational Institutionalism. And so in lots of chapters in there, all trying to think about really putting organizations at the top of mind in order to understand what's going on institutionally.
Another option would be most institutions, most organizations, and most people are really behaving within a space where there are more than one institution, right? So we have the family, and we have the market, and we have capitalism, and we have many institutions acting together. So one of the very interesting issues studies on the organizational level is how do organizations respond or struggle with competing institutions, where one institution really pressures you to do one thing and the other institution is going in another direction, and then you need to decide what to do. The organization needs to decide what to do. And what are the intra-organizational dynamics that allow organizations to really cope with this kind of, we call it multiplicity of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of research on the organizational and intra-organizational dynamics.
But essentially, empirically, what we're talking about is a bunch of people in the office kind of wanting to do different things because of either beliefs or maybe external regulations or their opinions of what it means to do the work well, right? So the competing institutions and incompatibility or compatibility essentially goes down to these individuals trying to do the work in the way that they either know or think is appropriate to do.
Right.
Or is there more to it?
Yeah. Because now what you're saying is the individual level. If we look at what people decide to do, that would be an individual level. But if I'm interested in the organizational level, then I need to look at, say, processes of decision-making within organization. But more than one person has to come to a decision and then to implement this decision. So that would be more of an organizational level analysis.
And then you look at the process or at the actual decision-making actors?
So it depends with what kind of approach we come. Within this process symposium that we are now part of, I would say that organization is also a process of organizing, mm-hmm. and then we can try to figure out how the institutional process and the organizational process integrate. So I would go for the process approach here.
Mm-hmm. And I guess then if we're looking at kind of organizations or processes within organizations, then the agency is kind of almost temporarily added to those entities for the sake of analysis, isn't it? Because institutions kind of depend on embedded agency to a large extent. Otherwise, it's just puppet masters or people with no indeterminacy or free will.
Right. We call them cultural dopes.
Yeah.
Are there cultural
dopes?
Yeah. And so, in fact, the term is meant to be provocative rather than descriptive.
Right. Yeah, sorry.
Well, I guess we can't all be super intentional all the time. There's always going to be some
in fact,
element
we are not.
Of action that is taken for granted.
Yeah. We're not. But yeah, I think your organizations do have agency. Right? So embedded agency is a term we try to use to reflect the mix of having some ability to determine what's going on, but also to be influenced by institutions in ways that you may not either have an ability to take action, or you may not really have any sense that that would be something to do. You just exist, right, within an institutional environment.
Maybe I can give an example.
Yeah.
So I studied a rape crisis center in Israel, and it was a feminist organization, and they tried to operate on the organization level differently. So they didn't want to have a hierarchy. They didn't have any manager. They used to switch between them who's making the decision. And then they wanted to apply for a government fund. And in all the forms that they had to fill up, they were asked, who's the manager? And they said, we don't have a manager because we're a feminist organization, stuff like that. And of course, they didn't get the money because the government wanted to see a hierarchy and they wanted to see someone is in charge. And it took them a few trials to come up with the idea that they need to invent a manager, that they have to have someone to do that. So they didn't think about it, they didn't see the entire institutional arrangement here, and it took them some time to understand how to play the game. And in the forms, there was this question because the idea of the organization as an hierarchical order is taken for granted, right? So it took them time to understand, and then they could act upon it. So they were within the system, it took time, it took reflection, and then you're able to act. So usually that's the thing. We don't, something disruptive has to occur for us to start thinking, and then maybe gaining the understanding that will allow us to actually act upon the institution.
Which kind of brings up one of the questions that drove the institutional theory world was, why do organizations look alike?
The isomorphism.
Isomorphism. But really, when you look around, organizations are much the same. And they have somebody who's called a manager. And they have, so there are many things in society that contribute to isomorphism. And that, I think we've probably had quite a bit of early work in that regard. And now not so much attention to it anymore. We take that for granted. That there is isomorphism. Probably if there's studies in that respect, it would be, why isn't there isomorphism in certain situations? But
that's actually something I was grappling with, not from an institutional perspective, but from a point of view of organizational memory. If organizations partake in the same practice, why are they not the same? What is it that makes difference between one and the other? And it is a difference that is felt very viscerally, even as you walk into two otherwise identical, let's say, accounting firms, they will not be the same. I think this conception, misconception rather, of institutions as these blocks that deny agency and determine behavior and that are static, it's just a failure of imagination.
Or a question of degree. So do most accounting firms really, do they look mostly alike? And so you can always make an argument probably for how they are alike. You may also be able to make an argument that they are different in certain ways. So it might be interesting to decide on which characteristics are they different. And then you might start to understand the ways in which it's possible to take on different form or different culture or a different approach to the job and still be an accounting firm. Yeah, so I don't know of anyone who studied this, but where I live, we have a public school system that everyone attends. And in that public school system, there's many schools. When you go into them, they generally look like a school, you know, and most of the things are there. But most people will tell you that different schools have different feels. Each one feels differently. And in our system, parents are also allowed to go and choose whichever school they want send their children to. So they go on visits and they'll, you know, and so there's these interesting differences within overall sameness. And that kind of speaks to, I guess, this idea that within a concept of maybe even embedded agency, but you've got some room to be different, but probably not too different, or else you're no longer that thing.
So we've got sort of choice, but within reason, almost at all levels, at the individual level, at the organizational level, and you probably don't know where the limit is until you butt up against it. If you try something different and you get told that's not doable or that's not what one does, then you've kind of hit some sort of institutional
boundary. You might. I don't know. I'm not sure where this would go.
You're touching on an ideological question here, if I may, from a moment, reflection from sociology of knowledge perspective. Institutional theory originated from sociology. And it really, if you are into it, then you really believe that the main forces that shape our lives are social, and that we as individuals don't have much agency. We do have the agency within, you know, a space of possibility created by these social forces. Now, this is really very much in opposition to what we believe in the business school environment, where we are more thinking capitalistically, and we want to believe that individuals really have all the agency in the world. You can do whatever you want, as long as you're willing to put all the effort and you have enough resources, right, and enough skills. So these are really two different ways to look about the world. And they are ideological in the sense that our studies cannot decide between them. It's, you know, it's a matter of belief. Do you want to believe that way or the other way, or do you want to integrate them in this kind? So I think institutional theory is very important, highlighting the social forces that really shape our lives. Mm-hmm. But then each of us has to decide for him or herself whether we want to believe that or we want to believe that.
I think there's times though where it's an experiential phenomenon.
Right.
And it's an interesting idea to me that it's the taken for grantedness of institutions that makes them so powerful. So in a sense, how do you tell the fish that the fish is in water?
Exactly.
There's a sort of attempt to prompt people to reflect on and then recognize the forces that are at work.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you come across them by accident. So just to give a small example, my university has a license to a particular software package that I would find useful for my work with industry. So I requested training in this, and the university offers the training, but I was told, no, you can't do that training because you're an academic. It's only for administrative staff that we have that training available. And in trying to break down this wall that I had hit, I found out that this was to do with accounting systems and budgets, and it went very deep in many directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have carried on with my life not knowing that that barrier was there. Was I butting up against some kind of institutional issue here, or
Maybe within, but like the boundaries, professional boundaries,
regulative forces.
Yeah. So the thing is, if you ask yourself, so what is the relevant of this?
Mm.
I think this theory is very relevant to our personal lives, to understand what are the, you know, institutions that shape our life. What is the relevance to managers and people within organizations? So the idea would be that if you understand the institutional context within which your organization really is trying to play out, then you may be able to start to reflect on that, just to understand what are the very broad pressures within which you are trying to operate. So, you know, personally, I believe that as long, even if I can't do anything against these forces, once I even see them and understand mm-hmm. that they are working on me, that's much better. Now I can mm-hmm. reflect on it, and then I can decide, do I want to bang my head against the wall and you know, try to make it happen that they will allow me to this training that I'm not allowed to do? Or maybe not. This is not the kind of struggle that I want to be involved in. But at least I'm making the decision, right? I'm trying to understand what's going on around me. So I think this is what institutional theory can contribute to people within organizations. Just open your eyes, try to understand the broader system within which you are operating, and then decide what you want to do with this knowledge.
It's a nice way to think about it, because I think a lot of people would say institutional theory has no relevance to day-to-day life. But if managers can understand the context within which they're working, which involves interacting with a lot of different institutions, and probably understand which ones are more malleable than others. You know, so there's some institutions, law, tax, I don't know, you know, some things that are very difficult and resilient, and you would be doing this thing of banging your head, whereas other, you may be able to accomplish things by knowing where the space exists to do things. So really back to my nurse practitioners that I studied, what they kind of revealed to us is probably more the right way of talking about it, is that it's because they were insiders that they understood their context so well, and they knew that there was a very strong hierarchy, professional hierarchy, and they also knew how physicians were likely to act. And so they could adapt their strategies about how to get things done in a way that nudged things in a significant way and made it possible for them to take on some new roles. So, you know, I think that this, we called them savvy, and I think it's a word that could probably be used for managers too. If you have savvy managers, they know, sometimes we say work the system, but in institutional language, we would say they know which institutions are existing in what ways and where, and what they can do about that.
I think that's a wonderful conclusion. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great opportunity to talk.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed it a lot. So thank you, Tamar.
Thank you.
And thank you both.
And that's all for this first installment of the special episodes from the International Process Symposium. We hope you really enjoyed this conversation and you found it interesting and valuable. We certainly learned a lot. During the discussion at the beginning of the episode, I remarked that institutional theory is not really my area of specialism, and I confess I came into the conversation with certain preconceptions that turned out to be either untrue or superficial, so this was personally a really rewarding discussion, and both me and Ella, we talked about this afterwards, and we learned a lot from these two wonderful scholars. Next week we are releasing second part of this special series. This one is going to be about process studies and about the conference, the International Process Symposium, featuring Professors Harry Tsoukas and Anne Langley, here on Talking About Organizations.